Hello and welcome to this podcast summary of the IASB board meeting between the 18th and 20th of February 2015. My name is Mark Byatt and I'm joined today by Steve Cooper, member of the IASB, and Alan Teixeira, senior technical director. Right, Steve, perhaps you could begin by introducing the discussion on revenue recognition.
Yes, thanks Mark. The ISB had an ISB-only session initially to discuss revenue recognition, and then we also met jointly with the FASB to discuss some specific issues. The ISB-only session was to introduce the issue of the consideration of the transition resource group's discussions on submissions that have been made to that body and how the ISB would deal with those. The TRG has already discussed 32 submissions to date. There are a number of others in the pipeline. And the staff reported to the board that in the majority of cases, the discussion within the TRG, whilst helpful in its own right, did indicate that stakeholders should be able to understand and apply the standards successfully in those cases. However, there were some topics that have been brought to the boards, the ISB and the FASB, for joint consideration about whether further clarifications are necessary. The board also discussed the process by which it would deal with these submissions and the recommendations from the TRG, and I think many on the board were cautious about making hasty changes to the standard for minor clarifications, and that the discussion by the board papers and the discussions at the TRG were all helpful in ensuring consistent application. Nevertheless, the board, many board members emphasized the need for quality implementation and consistent application, which is why the ISB, together with the FASB, then considered some of these specific issues for the purpose of deciding whether further guidance is necessary, including changes to the standard. So that took us on to the joint session with the FASB, and there were two issues that we discussed as a result of the TRG meetings. One was to do with licenses of intellectual property, and the second one, identifying performance obligations. Now there's a very detailed summary of this within update, so I'm going to give a fairly high level indication of what the board has decided. In particular, it should be noted that the ISB and the FASB did come to some different decisions on this. And the IASB, whilst there's some common decisions in terms of changes that are proposed, the FASB did go further than the ISB and recommended additional changes beyond what the ISB considered was necessary. So I'm not going to give a full list of what those changes, particularly by the FASB, are, so I would emphasize that people should look at the update for the full list and a full explanation of that. The first of the two issues that we discussed is determining the nature of an entity's promise in granting a license. Both boards decided that some modifications to the standard, to the application guidance, is necessary in this case to ensure consistent application. And we decided to improve the operability and understandability of that application guidance by proposing to clarify that an entity's promise to a customer in granting a license is to provide a right of access to the entity's intellectual property. This is the one that's satisfied over time. When the contract requires or the customer reasonably expects the entity to undertake activities that significantly affect the utility of the intellectual property to which the customer has rights. And then we give two situations where the utility of the intellectual property to which the customer has rights is significantly affected. And it's either where the expected activities of the entity are expected to change the form of that intellectual property, or the value of the intellectual property to the customer is substantially derived from or dependent upon the expected activities of the entity. And an example of this is the value of a brand or a logo, which is typically derived from or dependent upon the entity's ongoing activities. Now that all sounds very complex, and you'll see a longer explanation, a fuller explanation of it in update. But that was sort of the key area that we discussed. Now, the FASB actually went a stage further than that and made some additional recommendations. So the changes that the FASB is going to make to its standard will be more extensive than the change which I've just described in respect to, of the ISB's changes. The other area, sales-based or users-based royalties, we decided to clarify the scope and application of the application guidance on sales-based or usage-based royalties, and this particularly applies when that's a component of a contract, and it's a question of whether you do or don't split in that situation. So we made some clarifications on that. Also, we discussed the second issue, rather, is the discussion of identifying performance obligations. Both boards decided to add some illustrative examples to the new revenue standard to clarify how the boards intend the guidance on identifying performance obligations to be applied. The FASB also went a little further in this area and proposed some additional changes as well to the standard. And in fact, the FASB then added some further changes in respect of shipping and handling activities and also some additional technical corrections. So you can see that the ISB has thought about the changes that the TRG put to it, decided to make some clarifications in some areas. The areas where the FASB has made some additional changes, the ISB assessed that it didn't believe that those changes were necessary in order for consistent, high-quality application of the standard to apply. Now, the FASB is going to propose, is going to issue a proposed update to its standard shortly. The ISB has decided not to issue a proposal and exposure draft at the same time. We decided that we would keep the changes that we've tentatively decided on, assess whether any other changes are going to come out from the transition resource group's activities and board consideration of that, and then we will issue an exposure draft in due course to propose changes to these. Now, of course, all the changes that we would propose to the standard will go through the normal due process, so it will be in the form of an exposure draft, not a straight change to the standard.
And I think it's perhaps worth emphasising, Steve, these are clarifications. None of these decisions essentially change the fundamental nature at all of the revenue standard. And it's the sort of thing that emerges inevitably when people start to work with the standard and dig deeper into their transactions, and there's a little bit of uncertainty about exactly what the words mean. So, as you've indicated, we didn't think that it was necessary in some cases to go further because we think the words are sufficient to get to consistent application.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Perhaps we could stay with you to provide the update on leases.
Yeah, this is the discussion that we had on transition, also leases of small assets and a sweep issue on sublease discount rates. Let me focus really on the transition and leases of small assets. This is the first time the board has discussed transition in its redeliberations of the second leases exposure draft. We've decided to make some changes to transition to try and simplify it, make it more cost-effective. There was a proposal in the ED to allow either full retrospective or a modified retrospective approach to transition. That's been kept. However, we have provided further relief in the modified retrospective approach. Now, there's a list of 9 different things in update that people might want to go through that describes exactly how this modified retrospective approach applies. But if I can just pick on 1 or 2 to illustrate, we've decided that we would not require in this modified approach the restatement of comparative information. So this will considerably simplify the transition process. Also, one is permitted to apply a single discount rate to a portfolio of leases and to use the discount rate applicable at the date of that transition, so you don't have to go back and then reassess retrospectively what the discount rate would be from the inception of each of those leases. And as I say, there's a number of other aspects to this modified retrospective approach which is designed to simplify the transition to the new lease standard, whilst not fundamentally changing the figures that would be provided in terms of reducing their relevance. Obviously, there's a compromise in not doing full retrospective, but we've tried to structure this modified retrospective approach to give as much comparability as possible, whilst at the same time providing cost relief to preparers. The other key issue that we discussed is small ticket, small asset leases. This has been a particularly controversial area where the IASB decided that to provide cost relief to preparers, it was important to not only emphasize materiality as an important consideration in applying a standard, but also to give the ability for a preparer to disregard leases of small assets. Now, many of these would not be material, and therefore the application of materiality would automatically mean that they would be exempt. But in order to remove the burden from preparers in proving a lack of materiality, the IASB has decided to reaffirm its tentative decision to permit a recognition and measurement exception for leases of small assets. We also decided that where a small asset is dependent upon or highly interrelated with other leased assets, then you wouldn't then qualify for a small asset, because obviously it'd be part of a larger asset. And we would also include in the basis for conclusions a discussion of the order of magnitude that the ISB has in mind in terms of these small assets. So that's a further indication of the board's desire to provide cost relief to preparers in this leasing standard. There were some other aspects of leasing discussed, particularly transition for sale and leaseback transactions, which again is aimed to provide cost relief, first-time adopters and lessor transition. But I'll let people read update for those additional details.
Thank you, Steve. So in addition to revenue recognition and leases, which were substantial portions of the board meeting, a number of other items were discussed. Alan, perhaps you could update us.
Sure. Thanks, Mike. Start off perhaps with the post-implementation review of our business combination standards. This is the second post-implementation review that we've undertaken. I think it was last December, Steve and I discussed the basic results of the review. And the staff identified, I think, 12 or 14 different issues that came out of the review. And the top four were the ones we really focused on today. Now, three of them are all to do with goodwill. And the goodwill is relation to the impairment test. We have an impairment-only test for goodwill at the moment. And some have suggested that the impairment test in IAS 36, impairment of assets, isn't working as well as it perhaps ought to. Is one of the premises of going to an impairment-only test is it has to have an effective goodwill test. Impairment test. Related to that is there has been a call by some to reintroduce the amortisation of goodwill. It's something the FASB is looking at, and I raise that because it is a converged standard. And the FASB is required to have a look at that because they've just introduced that for private companies, and part of their process is they're now required to at least ask the question as to whether it should be looked at again for public companies. And the third thing related to goodwill is identification and measurement of intangible assets that are essentially indefinite-lived assets, and people focus on brand names in particular, although some look at customer relations as a difficult one. Now, of course, the more you identify as an intangible asset, the more it affects goodwill initially when you recognise it. The other item on that list is the definition of a business. It's something our Interpretations Committee has previously had a look at and deferred work on it until the review had been finalised. Now, what the board decided last week is that we will continue to do some work on this as part of our research programme. So it's early days for us because the decision was only a few days ago about how we cast this, whether we put, for example, goodwill in terms of impairment amortisation and also the components of other intangible assets into one little thread of the project and perhaps separate our definition of a business. But we are certainly going to do some work on that. And I think the discussion at the table, the board members were keen to make sure that we cooperate with the FASB on the work to try and keep this as a converged standard. Perhaps if I move on, the disclosure initiative was at the table again. There's been a lot in the press in the last few months about alternative performance measures and non-GAAP numbers, etc. That was the subject of this month's discussion. And the first question you have to ask is, what is an alternative performance measure? And we often hear in the press people quoting things like EBIT and EBITDA. They can be legitimate IFRS numbers if they are calculated consistently with the way we define and describe things like depreciation, interest, and so on. But what you often hear in the press is what I call the bad versions of them is when people adjust them in some other ways. It's not an IFRS adjustment. They're often looking for sustainable earnings before interest and tax, for example, or some sort of notion of permanent earnings. So they're recurring earnings, sustainable cash profits, and so on. These are clearly set out as being alternatives to the IFRS numbers. So the big question for the board is whether, as has happened in a few jurisdictions where the regulators have stepped in, that we should even allow alternatives to be put in place or presented on the face of, for example, the income statement. Now, the difficulty for us is that IFRS actually requires additional subtotals if it adds meaning, and we'd certainly expect to see if there was a particularly, I'll use the word unusual, but or strange activity during a year. You know, we've seen that happen. The example used in the board paper was a natural disaster that was in an area that was not normally subject to, say, earthquakes, for example, and the costs associated with that the company incurred, you might like to see that separated from the rest of their activities. And we don't want to stop people actually being informative in the financial statements. So the outcome of all of this really is that I think for our discussion paper, the board thinks it's appropriate not to prohibit the use of other measures or subtotals, and it's don't want to prohibit people presenting what we call non-GAAP numbers or supplementing them, for example, you know, things like churn rates for handsets, in other words, how often, how many new sign-ups you get as opposed to how many you retain. That can all be very, very helpful to investors. But what we do need to do is to put some qualitative constraints around it and make sure that if you pick up a set of IFRS financial statements, it's very clear what IFRS numbers are, and any additional subtotals, etc., are not given any more prominence, for example, in the IFRS. So really it was, I think, quite a balanced discussion around that. And this will feed through into the discussion paper that we're preparing for to issue at the end of this year.
Okay, and I believe there was some discussion about comment letters received on rate regulation and macro hedging.
Yeah, perhaps if I'll cover the rate regulation and then Steve can have a look at macro hedging. Just as a general introduction, whenever we have a public consultation on an exposure draft, for example, or a discussion paper, the first time we come back and actually do a comment letter summary, we actually call it that, a summary. We don't try to make any decisions. What we're trying to do is summarise the comments received, get a flavour of whether there's consistency in the messages among users or preparers, where the conflicts are there regional differences, and so on. And that helps us get a picture of what the responses are, and then helps us set up a plan for how we're going to re-deliberate over time. For the rate regulation, I think there was quite positive feedback that we were starting to get the right issues in here. For rate regulation activities, there are you go to lots of different jurisdictions, and often electricity companies is an example. There might be some regulation in place that guarantees supply within an area, that the government will actually have a regulation in place that allows people to set prices in a particular way, so they can actually recover additional costs. And it's particularly designed to help in some cases, like I mentioned natural disasters, but if you have a major storm that damages the supply routes, you can actually spend the money to fix it and then recover those costs through the way you actually you bill. And so you get some sort of government guarantee or support for that process. And we're trying to identify which ones of those types of regulation generate assets for the reporting entities, which ones might generate liabilities, and make sure that we account for those in a meaningful way. So really, it's getting the scope of these things. And that's, I think, going to be the discussions over the next few months. So I think we're scheduled to come back in April for the first targeted discussions.
Yeah, thanks. On the accounting for dynamic risk management, the so-called macro hedging, the staff actually brought only one half of the comment letter analysis. There'll be further analysis of other sections of the discussion paper in future meetings. I think it's fair to say that many of the letters indicated that the board understood the issues that were portrayed within the discussion paper. but I think there was much less agreement about whether the board has identified a viable solution to those issues. I think many of the preparers felt that the proposal for a portfolio revaluation approach, particularly some of the scope elements to that that was in the discussion paper, wasn't really going to solve the problems in this area of dynamic risk management, particularly dynamic risk management of interest rate risk by banks. Contrast that with some of the user feedback. Many of the users were quite supportive of the transparency that would be given to dynamic risk management and interest rate hedging from the proposals in the discussion paper. So several aspects of the paper met with quite a lot of user support, and that was borne out with additional work that we did in meetings, in separate meetings that we had with those users with an interest in this area. So I think it's fair to say that given the mixed reception, the board is probably not going to go ahead with exactly what was proposed in this discussion paper, and we do need to have a bit of a pause now to think how we might take this project forward. There are some good aspects of things that we proposed, but I think it's fairly clear from the comment letters that the portfolio revaluation approach as described is probably not going to provide us with the answer, the whole answer to this, and that the board needs to do some thinking about what exactly it wants to do in this area. But as I say, the comment letter analysis was only presented, one half of it was only presented to the board this time. We've got more analysis to come, and then no doubt there'll be some more lengthy discussions about the way forward after that.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Alan, just finally, perhaps you could summarise the discussions on the IFRS for SMEs.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. More of a process issue, if anything, in terms of we have a tension in a sense between IFRS and SMEs. We've tried to link that quite closely to IFRSs. And of course, when you develop new IFRSs, that's where lots of due process around that, lots of consultation. And then we have a look to see how we might modify that, particularly in relation to disclosures for SMEs. So we want to have that link. But on the other hand, it's very clear to us that they want stability, so they don't want constant change. And so the question really was, how often do we review these things? And what it came down to is the board decided that they should commence a review around about 2 years after the effective date of each new set of standards. Now, 2 years sounds pretty like a short period, but what I think that in reality means it's around about a five-year cycle anyway, because 5 to 6 years. Because if we're going to be issuing towards the end of the first half of this year, so in a couple of months from now, the amendments from our comprehensive review, the initial review that we did. And of course, we'll look at an effective date of 18 months or so from there on. So that's 18 months, then 2 years after that, we would start the review. And the review itself can take up to 2 years as well. So I think that's, we're trying to get a nice balance there between making sure that we don't lose that link with IFRS, but providing good stability.
Okay, thank you. Which is important, just looking at the latest stats, that half of all jurisdictions surveyed now have adopted the IFRS for SMEs. So encouraging developments. So looking forward to upcoming developments, we have on the 27th of February, we have the meeting of the Capital Markets Advisory Group. On the 4th of March, we have the Rate Regulated Working Group. And then on the 5th, we have the meeting of the Global Preparers Forum. Next board meeting will be between the 16th and the 20th of March. The Interpretations Committee meets on the 24th and 25th of March, the ASAF on the 26th and the 27th of March, and then the Revenue Recognition Transition Resource Group meets on the 30th, so March is going to be a busy time. So thank you for listening. It leaves me to give the obligatory health warning that these are the personal views of the presenters and may not necessarily represent those of the IASB. The official summary of the board meeting is provided by IASB Update, which is available to download from the IASB website. Thank you.